Our opening words this morning are by Barbara Peskin. For the beauty of the earth, this spinning blue-green ball, yes. Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place, to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcome us.
Our second reading today is The Summer by Mary Oliver. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Welcome, friends. Today the weather looks like it's taking a turn for the worst, but I'm grateful that my long-lost friend, the sun, said hi to me yesterday, and I hope one day I'll get to see it again. Well, today I want to talk about weather, about the climate, and about us. And to begin, I want you to ask you to imagine less benign weather, to imagine a time when fierce storms come and it rains day after day after day until there are floods, and those floods wash away crops, wash away homes, wash away livelihoods, wash away lives. That there are extremes of heat and cold, and the most vulnerable can fall victim, whether old or young or sickly. Maybe times when there's drought, and a drought lasts a year, two, three, that crops fail, that herds fail, that famine hits, that people are forced to migrate. And maybe the desiccated land catches fire and great forests burn, destroying habitats for man, for animal. And maybe even this is compounded by pandemics that decimate those that survive. So maybe you're imagining that I'm talking about what may soon be our apocalyptic climate future, a world where we've come to fear the weather. Perhaps, but I want you to recall that this is also our distant past. That 10,000 years ago, our ancestors' lives were precariously at the mercy of what seemed to be the whims of nature. Drought, flood, fire, famine was routinely part of their reality. So in this frightening existence, it's not surprising that to find some semblance of control, or at least of warning, that they would come up with gods that they could plead with, that they could appeal to, that maybe with the right ritual or with a sufficient sacrifice they could be protected or at minimum warned. And such gods became plentiful in every culture around the earth. Indra, Zeus, Thor, Shango, Set, Baal, Marduk, Chak, Rigen, dozens more, each who controlled various aspects of the weather. And with the right prayer, the right ritual, the right sacrifice, perhaps the rains would stop, or they would come. Now, the reality is that these prayers and rituals didn't always work. And maybe the sacrifice wasn't grand enough. Or there's always the problem. You curry favor with one god, do you end up upsetting another one? One god becoming jealous of the next. So one solution was monotheism, right? If you have one god, one set of rules, you have a rule book, tells you how to keep God happy, then maybe we can do better. And this was the god of Western culture. And according to the scripture, when God was displeased, think of Noah's flood, right? Think of the drought of Elijah. Think of the plagues of Pharaoh. It was fire and brimstone, right? It was environmental disaster with the consequences. Well, originally, as in our stories we heard earlier, gods were thought of in terms of animals, in terms of plants, the tree. And it gave us a certain connection with nature. But with time, that evolved, and we came to see ourselves in God's image. And in the process, we moved away from nature. And instead, we saw ourselves originating from a humanoid god. And we are told that we are to lord it over nature, much as God lords it over us. To quote Genesis, when God is talking to Adam and Eve, God said to them, "Bear fruit and be many and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the fowl of the heavens, and all the living things that crawl upon about the earth." So this frames us. It frames us as both separate from nature and above it. We're meant to own it, to use it, to rule it. And we've been incredibly successful at that. But in the process, we've come to see ourselves as profoundly somehow different from our fellow creatures. In ancient myths, it wasn't uncommon to have human animal hybrids, you know, like Ganesh I have here, a friend of mine. I collect gods on the side. Anubis and others. You can think centaurs, mermaids, fauns, minotaurs, right? There were many. And the stories we told were often about animals or people turning into deer, into ravens, into flowers. It was embodied in our stories, this connection, that we were of nature. But that transitioned. In Western religion, our stories are of tribes interacting with each other, with people interacting with each other, with people interacting with God. And that relationship with God became defined in a way that vilified nature. In the Christian religion, by the time of Augustine, the failure to transcend our animal self came to be seen as the cause of sin. We'd be born naked, but we're expected to immediately hide our shame. Original sin is that we are at heart animals, and then our bodies are going to betray us through base instincts like sex. And the church taught that our animal drives and our desires are our weakness. And we have to fight, because these weaknesses will unavoidably and inexorably lead us away from God. We're told that our goal is to deny and control our inner animal selves, and if we succeed, we can then follow God's will and be saved. But instead, if we yield to our inner animals, we're damned. This conception of ourselves as fundamentally and essentially separate from the rest of living organisms, that is somehow God's desire for us to deny and rise above our animal selves and to view the rest of life on the planet as resource, it's put us at war with both our inner nature and with nature as a whole. It has spiritually impoverished us, and it's added to our sense of isolation. It's led us down a spiritual cul-de-sac, which is our present environmental crisis. 200 years ago, born in Unitarian households, there were two individuals, Darwin, Thoreau, and they grew to challenge this separation between humans and the natural world. The consequences of Darwin's insight that all life evolves from a single ancestor was that we were not inserted into this world above nature or even somehow separate from it, but that we're entirely of nature. We're as fully a part of it, and each of us is as amazing as a butterfly, an octopus, a giant redwood. We're fully and completely related to each and every tiny branch of the tree of life. And gorillas and chimps we may see as our cousins, but so are elephants, and so are tulips, and ants, and coral, and paramecia. Each has evolved the same 4 billion years, perfecting what we are. And when we leave our buildings and we go for a walk in the woods, it feels energizing. It feels refreshing. It feels renewing. And I think it's because we're connecting with old relations. In effect, it's a family reunion. That we're the prodigal child coming home. So what did Darwin think of this theory? Well, this is the final sentence from The Origin of Species. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Grandeur in this view of life. We're part of a miraculous process. We're no longer alone and isolated, standing outside of nature, looking in. When we understand evolution, it thrusts us back fully, intimately, fundamentally, into the very center with the rest of creation. Each of us, we're all descended from the same primordial ancestor, copies of the very first DNA exist in all of us, in every living thing, to be passed to the next generation. Now, it's sad that Western religion has resisted the grandeur in this view of life. They have not rethought our relationship with nature and the spiritual implications that would have come. And at worst, many churches have chosen to demonize and ridicule evolution and to fight its teaching in our schools, and with too much success. A 2017 Gallup poll shows 38% in the U.S. believe, quote, God created humans in their present form at one time within the past 10,000 years. 38%. Well, maybe you take solace. Well, at least it's only 38%. But the fraction that believe human beings have developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life is only 19%. Half as many. Well, that's our more fundamentalist brethren. What about the more liberal Christians? Well, they have moved. And at best, they seem to have adopted a position of stewardship and replaced the idea of dominion, and that we need to look at nature as God's gift to us, to be cherished and to be taken care of. Liberal Judaism has a similar concept that they've embraced called tikkun olam, which means it's a directive from God, and it tells us to mend the earth, to heal it. And believe me, these are steps in the right direction. But we need to do more. That holding on to ideas of human supremacy, I think, are every bit as wrong and every bit as dangerous as the delusions of Aryan or male supremacy were and continue to be. The older view, to see a tree as God's gift, to rule, to use and abuse as we wish, it's unhealthy for nature, it's unhealthy for us. And while I think it's better to see the tree as God's gift, to value, to protect, to heal, we have to go a lot further. And I say this as an atheist. We really need to see ourselves and a tree, whether the tree of life or just a tree, as fully embodying God. And when we damage the tree, we're not just disrespecting a gift. We're putting that axe into ourselves and into God herself. When the day comes when our evangelical brethren come around to this view and truly believe in the sanctity of life, and they champion it with the same energy that they've shown for other issues, it'll be a day of great rejoicing. So what if? What if we fully incorporated the consequences of evolution into our experience and thought? Well, for one thing, we naturally divide the world into those that are within our sphere of empathy and those that aren't, the other. And we do this at many different levels. For some, it's right at the level of family, and family is seen as different than acquaintances, friends, strangers. You may feel an immediate bond. We may be more sympathetic. Empathetic, forgiving. Many have moved beyond just family as their concern, and different groups, religious groups, tribal groups, nations. Some go beyond that and they can see the entirety of humanity as within our concern. And as you get broader and broader, the other shrinks more and more. Right, until we can feel that part, our connection, and all of humanity becomes us. Well, likewise, when we wake up and accept the knowledge that every living thing is a relative, has the same basic metabolism, the same primordial DNA, we experience nature differently. For me, I get a sweet little thrill every time the chalice, including today, when the chalice is lit. Because it reminds me, and I see it as a celebration, that there's a chemical reaction in each of us. It's that same reaction, and it's in every single living thing. And to acknowledge that there's a religion that somehow, I believe, acknowledges that is a very sweet thing. And when each week I see the flowers, particularly beautiful today, I noticed, I see it that we have chosen to celebrate the beauty and the variety of forms that our living relatives take. Now, many Christians believe in a story arc for humankind, and it begins with the fall from the Garden of Eden and ends up with a life in paradise. Well, it's useful to know that paradise is a Persian word. It means a park. It means a garden. And so I think there's a deeper metaphorical truth in this story arc, that maybe we left the Garden of Eden when we separated ourselves and seeing ourselves as apart from nature. And perhaps we'll return to the Garden of Paradise when we can reclaim our place as part of nature. Thoreau and the Transcendentalists saw this. Their spirituality was nature. It wasn't man-based. Thoreau warned that lordship over nature leads down a very negative path. If I may quote, "By avarice and selfishness and a groveling habit from which none of us is free of regarding the soil as property, the landscape is deformed, husbandry is degraded with us, and the farmer leads the meanest of lives. He knows nature but as a robber." Instead, Thoreau thought, again to quote, "I enter swamp as a sacred place, a sanctum sanctorum." So it's not in churches with their straight-backed pews where spiritual fulfillment is found, but it's on the lake. It's chin deep in a swamp. It's laying in the meadow. When we enter the woods and we leave behind civilization, I can feel the cares and the fears evaporating away. I feel calm. I feel bliss. I feel an inner unity. I feel my senses open up. They become alive. When I look, whether it's in intimate detail or in the grand scope, I mean, I see the beauty. I see the beauty of my sibling, living beings. And when I listen, I can hear a polyphonic harmonies, nature singing its songs. And I feel embraced by awe, by love. And I become aware again of the profundity of the deeper connections, and the illusion of isolation evaporates. And I realize it's a great irony that in a crowded city, I can feel very isolated. But in pastoral solitude, I'm now connected. Well, we're not random people in this space. We're UUs. We have a certain heretical worldview based on our principles. And there's something there that in the past has led individual UUs to be at the forefront of the founding of our nation, at each of its great reforms, the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, civil rights, environmental movement, women's rights, marriage equality. In each case, you youths have had an outsized role, first as individuals and then as an institution. Historically, what has happened is the liberal congregations have followed our example. And then with time, the mainstream denominations also come along. Martin Luther King said the church is the conscience of the state. And our historical role, as you use, has been to again and again to show the way when it wasn't popular. And we'd pull the other religions reluctantly into the future. I think it's time again that we have to lead towards a radical environmentalism that fully embraces our position in the web of life. The headlines every day can be terrifying, particularly on climate. Just this week, we learned that the extinction rate has gone up 100-fold, that 1/4 of the species on Earth are threatened, that millions of species will soon be vanishing. These headlines, they scream at us. They scream that we have to embrace that message of Darwin and Thoreau, and we have to make it central to our spirituality. The profound idea is this. We are not apart from nature. We are a part of nature. We are not apart from nature, we are part of nature. And our sense of isolation is an illusion, and it vanishes when we go into the wood or the meadow or at sea or even in space. Nature and spirituality are intertwined. They each inform the other, they each strengthen the other. And the interdependent web of life is not just to be observed or even protected or healed. It's not just something we're caught up in. It's us. We're the web. Damage that is done to nature is damage we do to ourselves and those we love. And when we and those we love are in danger, we don't ask, oh, is it going to cost too much? It'll be inconvenient. Can someone else take care of it? No, we respond. William Lloyd Garrison, when he was writing about the urgent issue of his time, slavery, said, "I'm aware that many object to the severity of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of the ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I'm in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard." These are times for urgency and drastic action. It is time for us to panic. But we can't afford the paralysis that comes from panic. We can't become immobilized by the despair. We can't adopt denial. The answer has been spoken before from this pulpit. It's active hope. The hope that Cornel West spoke of. The hope that looks at the evidence and says, it doesn't look good at all. It doesn't look good at all. Going to go beyond the evidence to create new possibilities. Well, today, it doesn't look good at all. It doesn't look good at all. But I have seen in my life the seemingly impossible happen again and again. Some 3 years ago, all with one year, several amazing things that I think anyone would have thought was impossible occurred. The World Wide Web was invented. Apartheid started to end. The Berlin Wall fell. The Soviet Union was dismantled. The Cold War ended. I was alive then. Each of these was a seemingly impossible miracle. There was no path seen to how those things would happen. And they did. And that was just 1 year. And if we go back 24 years before that, there was a time before computers when, using slide rules, saved mine, we were able to use this and somehow get ourselves from Earth to the moon. Right? I can think of that our society was able to mobilize around that and do something miraculous. And more recently, until it happened, who really believed that a black man could have been elected president of this country? So miracles happen, and they require hope, and they begin with a dream. And Martin Luther King Jr. saw that. Fear, it can energize, but it narrows our view, and it shuts down our options. Dreams, they enkindle the imagination, and they shape what's possible. Yesterday, someone pointed out Harvard professor Greg Norris, and he does research on human impacts on the environment. It's known as footprints. And how can we each minimize our footprint? But he found it was a depressing task because we're trying to get towards zero. We can never get to zero on our impact except by not existing. And it just didn't seem hopeful. But then he reframed it. And he thought, well, yes, we make footprints, but we also have handprints. We can also do positive things. And why don't I start quantitating that? He had a dream, and it reframed everything. It reframed it from fear to hope. Well, now it's our turn. We have to react to this urgent moment. We have to find our dream of the future. We have to hold hope as an ally. And we have to act to save our pretty planet. For good or for ill, we have an outsized effect. People can do things that our fellow life forms cannot. We can find new purpose as we dream our own improbable moonshot. Peoples, nations, life uniting together to take on our greatest challenge yet. We need to work together to save our common future.